I'm going to temporarily back up to slide 20 just to make a good segue into today's first slides, because it deals with slide 20. Slide 20 shows you how other things besides glucose can feed into the glycolytic pathway. Remember, we were talking about galactose and fructose being, besides glucose, also very common monosaccharides. And fructose, we already talked about how the liver processes that. Galactose is what we'll start with. But just to quickly recap on 21, what the liver does with fructose, it phosphorylates it, remember, into fructose 1-phosphate. So that's a hexose with just one phosphate on it. Then it splits it apart. So when you split that apart, you have a phosphorylated triose, dihydroxyacetone phosphate, but the other triose is not phosphorylated. So the second step is that the liver phosphorylates that glyceraldehyde into glyceraldehyde-3-phosphate. So now you have exactly the two things that you would make in the fork of the road after stage one of glycolysis to begin with, even if you'd started with glucose. So the rest of it can continue just as if you'd started with glucose. Now, on to today's material, slide 22. Galactose, a valuable monosaccharide, can be fed into the glycolytic pathway as long as you modify it first, and that's exactly what we're seeing happening here. Galactose on the left gets phosphorylated into galactose 1-phosphate, and it makes perfect sense to call the enzyme responsible for that galactokinase, right? It phosphorylates galactose, therefore it is acting as a kinase. And it's phosphorylated, obviously, at the first carbon position, which is why it's galactose 1-phosphate. Now, that's just the first step. There's actually four steps in getting this fuel ready for the glycolytic pathway. What the four steps accomplish is converting the galactose into glucose, which of course does go into the glycolytic pathway. So that first step made galactose 1-phosphate. Okay, that's what we see on slide 23 in the upper left in pink. The second step involves a reaction between that galactose 1-phosphate that was just produced in the previous step and UDP glucose, which we briefly talked about before. What does the UDP stand for? Uridine diphosphate, right. Uridine is simply the name for the nucleoside consisting of uracil and ribose. Okay, so instead of having adenine, which would make it adenosine, it has uracil, which makes it uridine, and it's carrying two phosphates, so it's uridine diphosphate is itself, if you just consider it itself, it is a nucleotide, right? A doubly phosphorylated nucleotide. But it's hanging off of that terminal phosphate is glucose. So that's why the whole thing is called UDP glucose. Now this is already present. There's a pool of this UDP glucose in the cytosol. Now, it's called UDP glucose because of what I just said. It's a UDP molecule with a glucose stuck on. But notice how it's pictured here in color. You can also think of UDP glucose as being a UMP, a uridine monophosphate, which would be just the black part, right? With a phosphorylated glucose connected to it. It's the same molecule, it's just describing it two different ways, right? So the phosphorylated glucose is the blue part. That's really what you want to get out of the situation. So when the galactose 1-phosphate and the UDP glucose react, what happens is that the uridine monophosphate part, the black part of UDP glucose, drops off that phosphorylated glucose and instead latches on to the galactose 1-phosphate. So when that galactose 1-phosphate is picked up by this nucleotide, that makes UDP galactose instead of glucose. Okay? But what the UDP glucose dropped off is now just glucose 1-phosphate here in this little box by itself. Okay? So that's the second step. And the glucose 1-phosphate, in a sense, is the important part, because that's the part that's going to be go through one more modification and go directly into the glycolytic pathway. So it's the fuel at this point. But the third step is to isomerize UDP galactose into UDP glucose. Okay? Remember that UDP glucose is what you started with up here in the second reaction on the top of this slide. Well, glucose and galactose are isomers of each other. And if you recall the carbohydrates chapter, when we talked about the different kinds of isomer, one class of isomers were epimers, remember? Epimers differ in the arrangement of things stuck to asymmetric carbons. So that's why it makes sense that the enzyme responsible for that is UDP galactose 4 epimerase, because it makes one epimer into another epimer of these categories of epimers. Okay? The important reason for this is because this gets you UDP glucose back. It recycles UDP glucose, which you started with to react with galactose, 1-phosphate. So it recycles the UDP glucose, but in the process it yields glucose 1-phosphate in this second step. And that second step, the top of this one, as you see, is galactose 1-phosphate uridyl transferase enzyme doing the job. Okay? It's transferring a phosphate, basically. The glucose 1-phosphate, though, that now is on its own, like I said, that is the fuel. This third step regenerates UDP glucose so it can keep doing its job, assuming there is more galactose 1-phosphate available. And so all we need to do now is deal with this glucose 1-phosphate appropriately so that it can go directly into the glycolytic pathway. That's the fourth step, actually, which isn't shown here. But if you think back, if you demonstrate your knowledge of glycolysis, what form does this have to be in order to go feed directly into the glycolytic pathway? Right, glucose 6-phosphate, not glucose 1-phosphate. Okay? So this thing needs to be slightly rearranged. All that needs to happen is that the phosphoryl group, which is on the 1 spot, needs to be put onto the 6 spot instead, right? Then you have a glycolytic intermediate and go directly into the pathway. Well, since all you're doing is moving around a phosphoryl group, which is a functional group, what class of enzymes would do that job? What kind? Well, it is a special kind of isomerase. It's acting as an isomerase. But more specifically than that, what do we call isomerases that just take a functional group from one place in a molecule and put it somewhere else in that same molecule? A mutase, exactly. So the enzyme responsible for transforming glucose 1-phosphate into glucose 6-phosphate is called phosphoglucomutase, which makes sense, right? It's turning one phosphoglucose into another phosphoglucose, just differing in the position of the phosphoryl. Okay, 24 now. This graph shows you how the main controlled enzyme of the glycolytic pathway is sensitive to energy charge. First of all, remind me what the main controlled enzyme of the glycolytic pathway is. There's three reactions that are non-reversible, right? And therefore they are control sites. But one of those is more important than the other two. Phosphofructokinase is the main enzyme of control. It's the committed step. It's the one that catalyzes the committed step. So phosphofructokinase is the most important one for controlling the overall pathway called glycolysis. By the way, what does phosphofructokinase do? As its name implies. Right, it phosphorylates a fructose that is already phosphorylated. So a phosphorylated fructose is called phosphofructose, right? If you phosphorylate that again, it takes a kinase to do that, which is why this thing is called phosphofructokinase. And that turns it into a doubly phosphorylated fructose, right? Fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. That's the step that is that's the committed step for glycolysis, and that's what a phosphofructokinase controls. Its allosteric regulation is partly under the control of energy charge. And what did I define energy charge to be? It's a ratio. But a ratio of what? It's the ratio of doubly or triply phosphorylated adenosine nucleotides out of the entire pool of adenosine nucleotides. That's just in words saying what I already said in the previous lecture mathematically. I said that the energy charge is equal to the concentration of ATP plus the concentration of ADP divided by the concentration of all three possibilities, right? ATP, ADP, and AMP. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. It is one half because that's only one half of the phosphoryl transfer potential power compared to ATP can donate two, ADP can only donate one. But the point here is not so much that specific formula. What it means is really more important. Energy. This numerator of this fraction is going to be big if there's a lot of ATP or ADP, which is useful energy-storing molecules, right? In terms of spending energy, it's useful. Whereas AMP is spent. So you have a certain number of adenosine nucleotides, whether they're ATP, ADP, or AMP, right? If most of them are in the form of ATP, then your energy charge is high because it's going to make that numerator big. But if you have a depleted pool of adenosine nucleotides, meaning you've spent a bunch of them, they're mostly in ADP or AMP form, then the energy charge is low. So when energy charge is high, that means the cell needs energy at the moment. It's short of energy in the form of ATP. When it's high, there's plenty of ATP. So this is a useful signal for controlling glycolysis because glycolysis is about making ATP, right? Okay, well, that main controlled enzyme, phosphofructokinase, has a site on it, an allosteric site, where ATP or AMP can bind to it. If ATP binds to it, we have the green trace. And notice what we have here is reaction velocity, how quickly the reaction is occurring, the conversion of fructose 6-phosphate into fructose 1,6-bisphosphate, and therefore, overall, how quickly glycolysis is occurring. That's plotted versus fructose 6-phosphate concentration. In other words, substrate concentration, right? Because this is the substrate of this enzyme, for this enzyme. So as you expect, you would have the shapes of the traces we've discussed in previous chapters. Well, when there is low ATP, that means the energy charge is low. That means there's going to be, at the same time, a higher level than normal of AMP, right? I said that either one of them can bind to the allosteric site on phosphofructokinase. But if it's ATP that's binding, that's going to inhibit the enzyme. Whereas if it's AMP binding instead, that does not inhibit it. It just keeps ATP from binding there instead. Okay? So when the energy charge is high, which is a situation in which you would not want to bother conducting glycolysis, because you already have available ATP. Why waste fuel making more ATP? That shuts down the phosphofructokinase activity partially because you have this pink trace instead. So at any given substrate concentration, notice that there is a much lower reaction velocity compared to if ATP is scarce, which is when you really want to run this enzyme to do the job of making more ATP to make up for the fact that you're short on it. So it's feedback. I mean, it's negative feedback, classic negative feedback. It's undoing the error signal, but it's controlling this most important control point in glycolysis. And this is how things, this is the main way in which phosphofructokinase is controlled in skeletal muscle, for instance, which is very highly active tissue, or it can be. It comes and goes depending on what you're doing. But the energy charge in skeletal muscle can go up or down drastically depending on your activity. And therefore, glycolysis needs to be ramped up or ramped down accordingly in skeletal muscle. So that's what happens with phosphofructokinase. And we see this in a different way on slide 25. Same skeletal muscle in both right and left halves, but on the left half, notice that skeletal muscles are at rest. The person is at rest. The muscles aren't working very hard. And therefore, glycolysis needs to be toned down, right? ATP is not needed in near the abundance it would be needed if the muscles were working. So why make it if you don't need it is the point here. PFK is phosphofructokinase. That's the main enzyme that's being controlled. But remember, there are three overall controlled enzymes in glycolysis. Hexokinase also is controlled, and so is pyruvate kinase. Now, what does hexokinase do? Phosphorylates glucose, right? Which is a hexose. That's the very first step. Pyruvate kinase is named for its reverse reaction, remember. But in glycolysis, it converts phosphoenolpyruvate into pyruvate, so it's the final step. Those are the three controlled steps. Well, we just mentioned that the high energy charge, meaning an abundance already of ATP, is going to shut down the activity of phosphofructokinase. That's the main way that this is inhibited. And the reason that there would be high energy charge in a resting muscle is simply because the muscle isn't using up the ATP at rest. All right? Notice, though, that ATP, or high energy charge, also inhibits pyruvate kinase. Okay. Now, hexokinase controls itself in a sense because hexokinase converts glucose into glucose-6-phosphate. So the immediate product of the step catalyzed by hexokinase is glucose-6-phosphate. And glucose-6-phosphate itself will inhibit hexokinase if it builds up. Okay? Now, why wouldn't it build up? Or under what conditions would it not build up? Yes. In other words, if phosphofructokinase is operating, then that's going to use up fructose-6-phosphate, right? Because the job of phosphofructokinase is to transform fructose-6-phosphate into fructose-1,6-bisphosphate. So fructose-6-phosphate wouldn't have a chance of building up in that case. And therefore, it wouldn't interfere with the activity of hexokinase. But if the glycolytic pathway is turned down because phosphofructokinase has been inhibited, you still have this earlier stuff before you get to the phosphofructokinase step that could continue to operate, right? Because you're shutting this thing down not at the very beginning, but in the middle. So the earlier steps could still continue. If that happens, though, that's going to cause glucose-6-phosphate to accumulate because it's no longer being used in the rest of the pathway. And that's what's going to interfere with hexokinase to turn it back off. Does that make sense? So hexokinase, the control of hexokinase controls input into glycolysis. Phosphofructokinase's control really is the main control of the whole pathway. And the control of pyruvate kinase controls the output, because it's the last step. On the right side, everything is reversed, basically, because the situation is reversed with respect to energy charge. When the muscles are busy, they are using a hell of a lot of ATP, and therefore the energy charge goes down. Low energy charge means that, notice how they write the fractions here. Low energy charge has a small ATP, small letters, big letters for AMP, meaning there's more AMP than ATP. That's going to make that overall fraction small. So low energy charge is going to mean that there's more AMP than ATP available to bind to phosphofructokinase. Well, that, like I said, does not cause the inhibition, but it keeps ATP from inhibiting it by AMP binding to that same allosteric site. So in other words, it relieves the inhibition, which is the same thing as turning it on, right? Effectively. And therefore, when phosphofructokinase is operating, the whole glycolytic pathway is operating. Okay, now, this bottom green arrow is an example of feed-forward stimulation. In this situation, fructose 1,6-bisphosphate, which is produced when phosphofructokinase is on, right? Because that's the step it directly catalyzes. That will activate pyruvate kinase. So in other words, fructose 1,6-bisphosphate, if it starts building up because phosphofructokinase is operating, but pyruvate kinase, which is controlling the output of the overall pathway, if that's still shut down, then you're going to get a buildup of fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. And that's going to signal to the cell, we need to open up that final gate, basically, so we can let this stuff out. And that's why it will activate pyruvate kinase so that the final step can go to completion. And therefore, that will fructose 1,6-bisphosphate will start being used up instead of interfering with this enzyme. Okay, does that make sense? Is that a yes? All right, I'll believe you for now. If we go to 26 now, we're looking at something that is more important in liver. We've just been, in the last couple slides, we've been talking about how glycolysis is controlled in muscle cells. Glycolysis in liver cells is controlled a little bit more complexly. Liver does not undergo drastic changes in energy charge. You know, you don't sprint your liver and then rest it. It's always operating in a pretty even keel, basically. So the energy charge doesn't go way up or way down. And therefore, it's not as an important a signal to control phosphofructokinase than something that does change in the liver. That's what we're looking at in slide 26. This molecule is fructose 2,6-bisphosphate. Now, it's very similar to fructose 1,6-bisphosphate, but it's different, right? One of those phosphoryl groups is in a different position. So this is not an intermediate of glycolysis like fructose 1,6-bisphosphate is. This is a slightly different molecule that's used as a signal to tell the liver the blood glucose level is rising. Okay? And we'll talk more about how this happens in the next chapter as well. But we're just looking at the structure here. You see the two phosphates. If this one on the upper right were connected down here, this would be fructose 1,6-bisphosphate instead. This is fructose 2,6-bisphosphate. In 27, we can see basically how this works. We'll look at more detail later, like I said. But fructose 6-phosphate, which is a player in the glycolytic pathway, it's an intermediate, if it starts building up, it can be converted into fructose 2,6-bisphosphate. Of course, that would require phosphorylation, right? That's all that we're talking about here. But it's phosphorylation that's different from the phosphorylation that occurs in glycolysis itself, because you're sticking that phosphate in onto a different position. All right. Well, fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, even though it's not an intermediate of glycolysis, acts as a strong regulator of phosphofructokinase in liver cells. So if there is fructose 2,6-bisphosphate building up, which is because glucose has been building up, then that will stimulate phosphofructokinase, PFK, in order to use that available glucose in the glycolytic pathway. Okay, does that make sense? Let's go to 28 now then. The third, the last controlled step in glycolysis is the final step overall in glycolysis, which is the conversion of phosphoenolpyruvate into pyruvate, right? That's the one that is catalyzed by pyruvate kinase, named for its backwards operation. But here in glycolysis, it's happening toward the right. Anyway, the two colored pill-shaped things here represent the pyruvate kinase enzyme. And notice the pink version is less active and the green version is more active. What renders this enzyme as less active or more active is whether or not it is phosphorylated. So this is separate from the phosphorylation of the fuel that we've been talking about. You can also phosphorylate or dephosphorylate enzymes as a way of switching them on or off. And you can't say, this is a common way of controlling enzymes. You can't say, though, that phosphorylation always turns it on and dephosphorylation always turns it off. It depends on the actual enzyme. In this case, phosphorylation of pyruvate kinase turns it down. It makes it less active. Notice the phosphate that's stuck to it. Now really that's a misnomer. It shouldn't be called PI anymore, because when it's stuck to the enzyme, it's no longer inorganic, right? But it's a phosphoryl group. It's just showing you that it was inorganic at one time and gets stuck on. Now it's just a phosphoryl group on the enzyme itself. Alright, so this overall enzyme that we're controlling is a kinase, because what it does, if it works in reverse for how it's named, would be to phosphorylate pyruvate into phosphoenolpyruvate. So that's one kinase. Of course, it operates in the reverse in glycolysis, so it's really dephosphorylating. But anyway, this one kinase that's in charge of taking the phosphate off of the fuel molecule, this kinase is actually controlled by another kinase, a kinase that will phosphorylate this enzyme, the kinase itself. So you have a kinase that phosphorylates the kinase. When the pyruvate kinase is phosphorylated, that's what turns it off. Okay? And that happens, as you see, under low blood glucose level. Low blood glucose level or high blood glucose level have effects in the endocrine system using mainly two hormones. What are the two main hormones for that signal the status of blood glucose levels? And they're opposites of each other. Insulin and glucagon, exactly. Functionally, they do opposite things. Insulin signals that there is a lot of glucose in the blood. So this is released by the pancreas in response to a meal being absorbed by the gut. So you bring in a lot of glucose, that tells the pancreas to release insulin. Insulin's effect is to get that glucose out of the blood, right? Glucagon is released under low blood glucose levels after fasting for a while. And that glucose has been used up in the meantime, so it gets low in the blood. In response to glucagon, there is a signal transduction pathway that is very similar to one that's does all kinds of things, and you've probably studied in 181 involving cyclic AMP as a signal, as a second messenger. Adenyl cyclase will catalyze the conversion of ATP into cyclic AMP, and then that will activate protein kinase A. Does this ring a bell for anyone? If not, the point is that protein kinase, which is a kinase, will phosphorylate something. In this case, it's phosphorylating pyruvate kinase, turning it down. And so the result of that is that glycolysis is slowed down, right? Because this is one of the glycolytic enzymes. Why does that make sense under low blood glucose levels? That's part of it. Yeah, there's less glucose available in the blood. But it's not so much just the fact that there's not glucose and therefore don't undergo glycolysis because the glucose isn't available. There still is glucose in the blood, otherwise you would be dead. But when it gets low, it would be very dangerous to use that glucose for any tissue that can use other things for fuel instead. The brain and the red blood cells need glucose as the fuel. They're not able to use other fuels. The brain, under normal conditions, so almost all the time, uses nothing but glucose. Under starvation conditions, it can use ketone bodies. But usually, it's running on nothing but glucose. And red blood cells, it doesn't matter whether you're starving or not, the only thing they can use for fuel is glucose. So when it gets low, since you don't do very well without a brain, the body responds by sparing that available glucose for use by the brain before anything else. And therefore, glycolysis gets shut down in the other tissues. Okay? They can use other fuels to make ATP. Just the opposite happens when pyruvate kinase is dephosphorylated. It turns the enzyme back on, but it's dephosphorylated when there is high blood glucose levels, which would mean that there isn't glucagon in the blood now because glucagon's stimulated or is secreted in response to low blood glucose, but glucose. Okay, let's go to 29. We have a family of glucose transporters in this table, as you see here. So they get the name glute some number. There's five shown here, but there's more than that that have been discovered. Anyway, these glutes are glucose transporters. That's what the T of glute stands for, transporter. What I'm talking about are membrane-bound transporters. So they are embedded in membranes of cells and therefore allow glucose to go through the membrane. All right? Well, notice that there is a column listing KM values. We talked about KM with respect to enzyme kinetics, right? But you can have a KM value for a transporter that's a completely analogous situation to an enzyme. What was KM in terms of enzyme kinetics? What is it? It gives you an idea for substrate affinity, yeah. It was defined as the substrate concentration at which the enzyme will work at exactly half of its maximal velocity, right? Well, for a transporter, the KM is the concentration of the transported particle at which the transporter works at exactly half of its maximal efficiency. Okay, so it's a totally analogous situation. But just like KM for an enzyme gives you an idea of the affinity of the enzyme for a substrate, the KM for a transporter gives you an idea of the affinity for a transporter. In other words, how much of that stuff that's being transported needs to be there in order for that type of transporter to work. Okay? The higher that number, the less the affinity that transporter has. And therefore, the higher the concentration of glucose in this case, the thing being transported, needs to be in order for it to actually go through this kind of transporter. Well, throughout the body we have glute transporters that have low KM values, which means you don't have to have very much glucose in the blood at all in order for glucose to enter cells via those transporters, which makes sense because that makes it efficient in getting glucose, the fuel, into the cells where it's processed by glycolysis to make ATP, right? Notice, though, the GLUT2, which we find in the pancreas and the liver predominantly, has a much higher KM. Now, this makes sense for both of these tissues. When blood glucose level is high, the pancreas needs to be able to sense that because its job is to respond to that high glucose level by releasing insulin. Okay? The insulin, by the way, tells the rest of the body, take in the glucose from the blood for yourselves. It allows the glucose to enter the cells of the body. But the pancreas needs to first know that that glucose is in great abundance. Well, it does that simply because it has these GLUT2 transporters, which because of their low affinity for glucose, aren't usually transporting glucose very rapidly into the pancreas. But once it gets to the high level where it's near the KM value of that GLUT2 transporter, then the pancreas is going to experience a rapid influx of glucose. It's going to receive a lot of glucose. That's how it knows blood glucose level is high, because its glucose transporters have a low affinity, therefore it takes a high concentration for it to enter the cell. Okay, that makes sense? Same thing's happening for the liver. And that's because, well, it's not because the liver needs the glucose for fuel when the glucose level is high in the blood. It's because of one of the big jobs of the liver. Whoops. One of the big jobs of the liver, among its many important jobs, is to do what with extra glucose when it's high in the blood? To store it in the form of what? Glycogen. That production of glycogen out of glucose is called glycogenesis. That's a major job of the liver. But you want to do that only when glucose is plentiful, when it's above the level it really should be. You don't want to take glucose out of the blood under normal situations and make glycogen out of it, because that's going to starve the brain. So you take it when it's too high, and that simultaneously stores the energy for you for later use by making that glycogen, while bringing the level down in the blood, which a high level of blood glucose can cause all kinds of health problems, right? Okay, that's the main point of 30. And in 29, we have a cartoon showing a pancreatic beta cell. The beta cells in the pancreas are the ones that specialize in secreting insulin. So there's not the only kinds of cells in the pancreas. These aren't the ones that make glucagon. These are the ones that make insulin. And this is a proposed mechanism for how this is happening. As the glucose comes in through those GLUT2 transporters, when glucose level is high, as I just explained, that's what's happening on the upper left, then that glucose is used for glycolysis, right, by the cell, because it, like any other cell, can undergo glycolysis. That leads to an increased production of ATP, not only because of glycolysis itself, but because of cellular respiration that follows glycolysis. In any case, the energy charge goes up in response to this inrush of fuel into the pancreatic beta cell. That ATP has the effect, the buildup of ATP has the effect of closing, which is what this X is all about here, closing what is a normally open potassium ion channel. Now, potassium ions are positive ions, they're cations, right? And they're important in producing and maintaining the cell membrane potential that you might have, well, you should have learned about that. Does everyone remember membrane potentials? Where is potassium in higher concentration? In which compartment? Intracellular fluid, yes. So if a potassium ion channel is open, diffusion, the gradient, is going to mean that it's going to diffuse out of the cell. Okay? That means you're going to be exporting positives, which is going to leave the interior negative, right? by comparison. So potassium coming out of the cell is the main reason why the resting membrane potential is at a negative voltage. Remember that? Okay, now all of a sudden, because of this influx of glucose and the ATP that's produced as a result, the potassium ion channels close, and no longer are you exporting positives, which means the interior is made more positive instead of staying negative. That's a change in membrane potential, just like that occurs at the end of a neuron in response to an action potential, that will open up voltage-gated calcium ion channels, the blue thing here, because that increase in voltage of the membrane will open up this calcium ion channel. All right? When it opens up, calcium is going to go down its gradient, which means it's going to enter the cell from the extracellular fluid where it's more abundant. And calcium is a versatile signal. It's used for all kinds of signaling in different cells. In the case of this pancreatic beta cell, the influx of calcium causes the exocytotic release of insulin. So these vesicles storing insulin have already been made. They're ready to go. When the calcium comes in, they're exocytosed and the insulin is released into the bloodstream. This is very similar to what happens at the neuromuscular junction. The neuron, when the action potential travels down the neuron, that change in membrane potential at the axon terminal also opens up voltage-gated calcium ion channels. And when the calcium rushes in there, you have an exocytotic release of neurotransmitter molecules. This is just an exocytotic release of a hormone, but it's basically the same mechanism. But the thing that gets the ball rolling is the influx of glucose, which is appropriate because insulin should be released when blood glucose level is high. Yeah? It allows the transporters in other cells to work so that glucose will leave the blood and go into those cells. And therefore, insulin has the effect of lowering the blood glucose level back down to normal, where it was elevated. And glucagon is released when it's too low, but its effect is to release glucose from the liver, which had stored it. It breaks that glycogen, which it has previously produced, back into glucose molecules and spills them out into the blood so that it comes back up to normal level. All right, that's one chapter and one recording.